This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Design Crowd. Design Crowd is a website that helps startups and small businesses outsource or crowdsource custom graphics, logos, and web design from over 500,000 designers around the world. Check out designcrowd.com/manliness. That's designcrowd.com/manliness to learn more and receive a special $100 VIP offer when you start your next project, or simply enter the discount code manliness when posting a project to Design Crowd. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Now, to the layman, financial investing can look extremely complicated. And while financial markets are certainly complex, the rules governing sound investment are actually pretty simple. The problem most people have is following those rules. It's all about behavior. Well, my guest today is a behavioral finance expert that has recently published a book crammed with practical advice to help investors from all walks of life have better investing behavior. His name is Daniel Crosby, and his book is The Laws of Wealth, Psychology, and the Secret to Investing Success. And today on the show, we discuss the psychological biases we have that cause us to make stupid investing mistakes, what we can do to overcome them, why index funds aren't exactly passive investments. We also explore how behavioral finance principles can help us live a happier, more flourishing life. Talk about why the self-esteem movement was terrible for you, what you can do to avoid resentment. And then we're also going to talk about another book he wrote, what's called Everyone You Know Will Die. It's for kids. It's kind of more, sounds morbid, but had a good purpose. We'll talk about that. After the show, make sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/Crosby. Search with a C, and you'll find links to resources mentioned throughout the show. So without further ado, Daniel Crosby and The Laws of Wealth. Daniel Crosby, welcome to the show.
Awesome to be here.
So you're a behavioral finance expert. What is that, and how did you get involved with it?
Yeah, so behavioral finance is just sort of simply sits at the intersection of psychology and investment management. And so my path there is pretty circuitous, and that's pretty typical of the two handfuls of people who work in this field. So I started school as a business major with an eye to going into investment management, which is what my dad does. And then I went on a mission for my church for 2 years and spent 2 years in the Philippines. And in that time, sort of got a bigger heart, enjoyed working with people, and came back and said, you know what? I want to do something that matters. I want to be a psychologist. Got about halfway through a PhD in psychology before I said, you know, this is bringing me down. Talking to sad people all the time is making me sad. And I want to think deeply about why people do the things that they do, but I can't do it in this context and still lead the life that I want to live. So was lucky to stumble onto this sort of unique business application of psychology. And so that takes two forms. You know, part of it is helping people make better decisions. And then part of it is, can we actually manage funds in a way that takes advantage of the irrational behavior of other market participants?
So you've got a new book out about using insights from behavioral psychology to be a better investor. But before we get to that, I'd like to talk about your previous book, You Are Not So Great, where you take insights from behavioral psychology to help folks live a good life. So let's talk about the title of that book, You Are Not So Great. So my mom and elementary school teachers were lying to me. Why are we not so great? How did this word greatness get spread too thin?
Yeah, so you're not that great is kind of built on the paradox that your ability to be great, which I want for myself and everyone else, but your ability to be great is predicated upon not thinking that greatness is your birthright. I'm not sure quite how old you are. I think we're roughly the same age, but you know, I grew up in the 80s at sort of the height of the self-esteem movement, where the thought was that self-esteem was the cure for all ills, and thought that self-esteem was given and not earned, and that took the form of, you know, lots of gold stars, everyone's a winner, participation trophies, things like that. And the science bears out that that's not the case at all. You know, I talk about a few things, but you know, I'll focus on two in specific. One, You're Not That Great talks about how special people are quitters. And I mean, make no mistake about it. I mean, I wrote this book. It was a TED talk that I turned into a book. But you know, I wrote this book for myself because I was a kid who grew up many things, especially academically, came easy for me. I was praised for being, you know, special, intelligent, whatever. And then I just fell apart the first time I quit. The first time I came upon any sort of bump in the road or any sort of obstacle, I just fell apart. And so I cite the work of Carol Dweck quite a bit in the book. And she just talks about working with kids and even yourself to focus on process over outcomes. You know, I think early in my educational life, my outcomes were good because I was just bright and it came easy to me, but you can only coast on that for so long and then you fall apart. So found pretty consistently in the book cases where people who just are leaning back on being special don't get very far because they just quit. And then the second thing that I found at citing the example of Bernie Madoff is that special people are cheaters. You know, in the book, I talk about research done by Dr. Carol Dweck, who worked in the New York City public school systems, and she divided kids into two groups. One she praised for being special and gifted, and the other she praised for being hardworking and following the rules. So then she asked the kid to write a letter to what is turns out to be a fictional pen pal. And in this letter to this pen pal, they're supposed to tell a little bit about the things they like to do, their hobbies, and then they're supposed to transcribe their report card. Well, of the group that were praised for being hardworking and following the rules, nobody fudged the grades on the report card. But of the group praised for being special and gifted, nearly half of the kids gave themselves better grades than they had actually received. So they effectively lied when writing to their pen pal. And we see this also in the case of Bernie Madoff. You know, a lot of people don't understand that Bernie Madoff was already enormously wealthy and successful before he started defrauding Holocaust victims. You know, he had already invented a market-making technology that serves as part of what we now know as NASDAQ. So he had made all this money, tens of millions of dollars, but he said he never felt special. He never felt special. He says in his deposition that he felt like a picked on little Jewish kid from Brooklyn. So again, he needed to be special, never got there in his mind. And you see that in both cases, it led to cheating. So that's the second reason, is that special people are cheaters.
Yeah, and I think that ties in with research I've seen about straight-A students or kids who think of themselves as straight-A students or gifted students, is they're the ones who are more likely to cheat. And I even saw this like anecdotally in my own life. The friends I were with that had this pressure of being the smart kid, like they cheated all the time, like on tests, or they would, you know, look at someone's homework because they didn't have time to do the homework the night before. So they would ask for their friend, they would copy their answers, very rampant. And it was because they had this pressure to like maintain that image.
Absolutely. I saw that in my own life. I mean, frankly, everyone writes a book to themselves, I think is the case. And this was absolutely written for me. You know, I was early on labeled gifted and a smart kid and didn't have to work very hard for it. So I learned bad skills and I learned to sort of coast on my natural gifts and then ended up being a pretty horrible student for a lot of years and a very lazy cheater, frankly, and had to sort of reteach myself later in life how to function because I had been given bad messages and hadn't taken personal responsibility.
And I mean, what did you have to do? Like, how did you reprogram yourself?
I was a horrible student all through middle school and high school. Had to go to a junior college. Had to go to a junior college because my grades were so poor. And it was at that point that it really sort of dawned on me that I was going to live in a van down by the river if I didn't get things together. And so at that point, I really started to work hard. Got great grades my first year of junior college, went on a mission for my church where I grew up quite a bit. And then after that, I was on a better path.
So you talk about contingent self-esteem and the two responses that humans take towards it. What is contingent self-esteem and what are our typical responses towards it?
So contingent self-esteem is self-esteem that's basically predicated on your self-esteem is predicated on someone else's lack of self-esteem. So the two things that we tend to do are either we build ourselves up to sort of this unrealistic level of overconfidence, or else we feel like we have to put others down. And in study after study, people it's been shown that people would rather make less money if it means making more money than their neighbors, right? So you'd rather be poor in a neighborhood where you're slightly richer than your neighbors than to be more objectively wealthy. So we really think about wealth and success and all these things in relative terms, and it's contingent on the people around us.
Gotcha. And how do you overcome that?
You know, I think the answers that I give in the book are just really sort of old fashioned and simple, but not easy. I mean, I think you have to learn to develop sort of a personal benchmark for greatness to compare yourself today to the man you were yesterday and not to your neighbor. And then the second thing that's just unequivocal in the research on self-esteem is that there's no shortcut to self-esteem. And the only way that you can get genuine self-esteem is by doing hard things and persisting in doing hard things until you've achieved something noteworthy. So people have a really strong BS meter. And so if you're telling someone, hey, well, you know, I'm so proud of you, you did so great, when they didn't really work for it, it doesn't stick. It's only when we do hard stuff and learn to do it well that gets internalized.
Gotcha. So let's talk about your latest book, The Laws of Wealth, where you take a look at the research coming out of behavioral psychology on how people can invest their money better. Because I think for a lot of just average Joes, like investing money in the stock market is just super intimidating. I mean, I invest and like, I feel like I'm a pretty smart guy, but like even like I'll look at the stock market, like I don't understand how this crazy thing works. But in the book, you make the case that most investing comes down to behavioral management. It's not so much, you know, what you put in your portfolio. I mean, that is important, but more importantly is how you just manage your behavior when you invest. So what are the biggest behavioral or psychological ticks that get in the way of us making wise investing decisions?
Yeah. So the first thing you mentioned there is one of the most powerful. It's just not realizing how empowered we are. You know, Ben Graham, who taught Warren Buffett everything he knows, Buffett would say, says that the investor's chief problem is himself. And that is absolutely, again, what the research bears out. There's research by a company called Dalbar that talks about the gap between what the market return has been and what the average mutual fund investor has gotten. And like over the last 30 years, the market has given you about 8.25%, but the average investor in the market has only kept about half of that because they get in and they get out at the wrong times. And so the first law of wealth, if you will, is just realizing that your behavior matters so much. And so financial professionals get this. You know, a recent study I read said that 83% of financial advisors said the biggest thing that they do for their clients is hold their hands and keep them from freaking out. But only 6% of the end clients thought that was the case. So there's this real disconnect where clients are looking for this sort of expert investment management, which is in a lot of cases an effort and futility, whereas the real value is delivered by just keeping you from making a handful of stupid decisions over your lifetime.
Gotcha. So they're more of like a coach.
Yeah, more of a coach. And people don't want to see them that way. People want them stock picking and doing the sexy stuff. And really, they're saving you from yourself if they're doing it right.
Gotcha. So, I mean, you list in the book several biases that we have that cause us to create, you know, make poor decisions. So you mentioned earlier, like we get out whenever things are tanking and then we get in when things are awesome. What bias is going on there that causes us to, it's sell low, buy high. So I guess it's what people are doing.
Right. I mean, there's a number of things at play there, but one of the things that's at play is something called the affect heuristic, which is just a fancy way of saying that your emotions color your perceptions of risk. And so there's been studies about emergency room admissions on days that the market is down, and emergency rooms admissions dramatically skyrocket whenever the market crashes. So we are just so immersed in this, and it's such a big part of our lives that it has an impact on our mood. So if you're in a bad mood, you tend to see risk everywhere. If you're in a great mood, you tend to not be very tuned into risk. And there's interesting research on this with respect to the spread of sexually transmitted diseases as well. It's like when people are in a cold emotional state, they know exactly what they're supposed to do to have safe sex. And then when people are feeling amorous, it's like kind of all out the door. So it's just, it's managing those emotions. And this is why I wrote a book on what I call rule-based behavioral investing, just trying to set forth a couple of simple rules so that you can kind of put this process on autopilot and really not think about it, because your thinking is colored by your emotion.
Gotcha. Well, yeah, that's really interesting. So how do most people invest their money? I mean, so like you promote this thing called goals-based investing. How's that different from the way most people go about investing their money?
Yeah, so the traditional model of finance has talked about mean variance optimization, which we totally won't get into, but it's basically trying to get the most return for every extra bit of risk you take on. And so in this paradigm, your goal is to try and beat the benchmark, let's say. So you want your portfolio to do better than whatever you're measuring it against. So let's just say for stocks, you want your portfolio to beat the S&P 500. Okay, so that's intuitive enough. But what I'm saying is you want the best anxiety adjusted returns, because we're all different. We all have different goals. We all have different wants and needs. We all have different meanings of wealth and expectations about how we want to live. And so all you need is the returns. You want to maximize the probability that you get the returns you want to live the life that you want to live. And that looks very different for different people. And that requires a deep consideration of what matters to you from sort of a meaning and purpose standpoint. And that requires a deep consideration of your personal risk tolerance. And traditional modes of finance have sort of kept that static across all market participants and assumed sort of similar goals and similar risk appetites. And obviously, that's not the case.
And so with goals-based investing, the goal isn't to beat the market. It's just...
Yeah. So one of the studies on goals-based investing that I love is they were working with low-income savers, like people who are just barely scraping by, and they're rightly having a hard time setting aside money. And so they tried carrots and sticks, you know, rewards and punishments. And then finally they said, you know what, we're going to try this. We're going to prime these people with a picture of their children before they make a financial decision. We're going to sort of flash up a picture of their children before they make a decision to spend or save, and we'll see how that impacts it. And with these low-income folks, it helped them set aside more than 200% more money than they had been before, just when they were thinking about that meaning and purpose before making a financial decision. So goals-based investing simply tries to reconnect money with the life that it serves.
So this was interesting. You had a whole section about index fund investing. I'm a big index fund guy. That's what I do. But you highlight in the book, the reasons why index funds are so appealing is that actively managed funds, right? Where there's a guy in charge, he's selling and, you know, rearranging the fund in order to get the best return. Those don't do very well compared to the S&P 500. In fact, most of them don't even meet their benchmark. But you still make the case that actively managed funds might be better than index funds. I'm curious, why is that?
So this is, I think, a conversation that takes a lot of nuance. So I'm gonna draw on the words of a guy that I love his stuff, Nassim Taleb, who wrote The Black Swan. And he says, never ask a man his opinion, only ask to see his portfolio. So I'll tell you that when I was recently putting together my will and putting together this, you know, for my wife, who isn't as interested in investing as I am, I said, if I get hit by a truck tomorrow, here are the allocations, and put it all in Vanguard. Because if you just want to not worry about it and manage fees, which is a great way to go, it's hard to beat index investing. So that said, I think that people who care enough to give it a little time and attention can do better than indexing over long periods of time. For a couple of reasons. So before I sort of go into that, I want to say that for the average investor who doesn't care about these things and just wants to live their life and set aside a little money each month, index investing and diversifying across many asset classes is absolutely the way to go. So there are a couple of psychological problems with indexing, though, I think. And one of them is that most indexing tends to concentrate you in the largest and most expensive stocks, which have historically not done that well. So the way that an index works is a stock takes up a bigger or smaller percentage of an index based on how well it's done recently and how the market cap of that company, so how big it is. And so if you have an index like the S&P 500, you are overweight companies that are large and expensive, which of course you're in effect buying high and buying big. And over time, smaller stocks outperform larger stocks and cheap stocks outperform expensive stocks. So with that in mind, I think there are some small tweaks that you can do to make it a little better. The other thing that I talk about in the book is how a lot of people think of indexes as being sort of mined from the earth or existing in a natural state. And what we see is that the S&P 500, again, is a secret group of nine people decides which stocks go in the S&P 500. So unfortunately, these nine people are subject to the same errors and biased thinking that you or I are. And so they've tended to do the wrong thing again. They've tended, at the turn of the century, the S&P 500 was loaded with tech stocks to a degree that was sort of not historically where they had been, but they loaded the boat with tech stocks because of the mania going on in the tech world at the time. And they were grossly overweight banking stocks in the 2007, 2008. And so because of this bias on their part, you, the investor, get screwed by their bias entering the equation. So I'm talking about what I call rules-based behavioral investing. If you put it on a continuum between what's commonly referred to as passive investing and active investing, it's probably somewhere in the middle.
Gotcha. I'm curious, what are your thoughts? So as I was reading that whole thing about index funds, like, maybe I should switch strategies. But at the same time, like, man, like I don't know if I have the time to like twiddle with my portfolio all the time. There are these companies coming out, like Wealthfront, where they I forgot what the other one is, where they basically create your portfolio via algorithm. Are they applying some of the research and behavioral science and just that to help people create a portfolio that fits for them?
So there's a couple of things that Wealthfront and Betterment, those are sort of the big two, and they're referred to in the industry as robo-advisors. I think there's a couple of things they do well, and I think there's a couple of things that are either room for improvement or maybe they haven't been fully tested yet. So what they do exceptionally well is they allocate you across a number of assets in a very scientific way. I mean, it's unbeatable. It's very, very good. The way that they diversify your portfolio and do so with reasonable fees. So that aspect is hard to beat. I think where the jury is still out, most of these companies are relatively new, and they haven't really seen periods of great market volatility. Most of these companies are like 5, 6, 7 years old, and I mean it's been a great 7 years. So what we find in the research is that people who work with a financial professional tend to outperform those who don't pretty dramatically by about 2-3% a year. And it's not because financial advisors are good stock pickers. It's because they're holding your hand and they're keeping you invested when times are tough. They're a coach again. And so I think where the jury is still out for me with robo-advisors is how do their participants react in a 30, 40, 50% drawdown. And interestingly, this week, you know, we're talking the week of the week after the Brexit vote, and I believe it was Monday of this week. Betterment actually shut down; they made their funds illiquid, like you couldn't get to your account. So they basically said, "Hey, we feel like people are going to make dumb decisions today," which they were, to be fair, probably right about. They said, "You know, we think people are going to make dumb decisions today, so we're just going to lock up your money." Well, maybe that's well-meaning, but it's also sort of not what their investors signed up for. So it'll be interesting for me to see how they try and manage the behavioral side of this over time. But their credentials in diversifying your portfolio are unassailable.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. All right, if you're a small business owner like myself, you'd likely send out a lot of mail, but here's the problem with mail. It takes up a ton of time. You have to drive to the post office, wait in line, wait on the clerk to print off your labels, and then you got to drive home. I was spending about an hour and a half a week just sending my mail, but not anymore after I switched to Stamps.com. Anything you do at the post office, you can do on Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. They also got this nifty USB scale that you plug into your computer, and if you got packages, just put it on the scale and it instantly creates the correct postage for a package. And after I print off and slap on my labels, all I gotta do is just walk down my driveway and put my mail in my mailbox for delivery. That's it. I've saved myself an hour a week just by switching to Stamps.com. If you're a small business owner and you want to save time on mail too, I've got an offer for you right now. Sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code manliness for this special offer. It's a 4-week free trial plus $110 bonus offer, which includes postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in manliness. Again, that's Stamps.com, enter manliness. Also by Squarespace. So take it from me, someone who's built several websites. If you don't know what you're doing about CSS or HTML or PHP, creating a website can just take a lot of time and it can be super frustrating. Squarespace takes all that frustration out, creating a great looking website that works across devices, desktop, laptop, tablet, mobile. It's just point and click. It's all it is. You just click and drag. You can arrange things how you want and it's going to look great. Also, when you sign up with Squarespace, they get a free custom domain. They've got lots of templates that you can use and customize. They've got 24/7 customer support. So if you ever run into trouble with your site, you can get in touch with somebody and get the problem fixed very quickly. And they also have some seamless e-commerce tools. So if you want to sell stuff online, they've got some really easy tools to use where you can do that. If you want to try Squarespace out at a discount, I got an offer for you. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter code ARTOFMAN at checkout. It's all one word to get 10% off your first purchase. Again, squarespace.com, enter offer code ARTOFMAN at checkout for 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, set your website apart. And now back to the show. So we talked about some of the rules, kind of tangentially, and I know we can't get into the specifics of all of them, but what are some of the rules in your rule-based investing, idea that people can follow to start being a better investor?
Yeah. So one of the things that I talk about, is consistency. So just having rules, I mean, and you know, whether it's as simple as setting aside X amount of dollars each month, or just making a hard and fast rule to, you know, buy every dip of 10% or more, just so you don't have to think about it. I mean, there's just an increasing literature on how really exceptional people just try and streamline their decision-making process. And I think this sort of checklist manifesto mentality is more applicable to investing than just about anywhere else. I mean, you see people like Obama who wear the same, you know, the same two types of suits day in and day out. You know, people like Nick Saban who eat the same thing for breakfast and lunch every day. You just want to free up that headspace for the stuff that matters. And I mean, investing, you know, it frankly doesn't matter very much in terms of living a great life. So consistency is one of the things that I advocate. The other thing that I talk about is conviction, which, you know, it's back to the active versus passive debate. It's a dirty little secret in the investing world that most funds that are marketed as being active don't differ meaningfully from their benchmark. And so what you get is expensive index funds, basically. And so you're eroding your performance. And a recent study found that basically 3/4 of funds that were marketed as active didn't really have an opinion. They were just basically what we call closet indexes. And so that's another principle is be in one camp or be in another camp. Either index like you do, which is sensible and a great approach and just save your fees, or seek out a fund that's truly differentiated and has an opinion, but never be in the middle.
All right. So consistency and conviction.
Yeah.
It's one of those two, I guess they're two C's.
Yeah.
So before we go, I mean, we've talked about living a good life, finances. We got to talk about this other book you wrote because I remember I got in the mail. I was like, "What in the world is this?" It's a book for kids, and it's a child's book about how people die. And I think it's called "Everyone You Know Will Die," right?
Everyone you love will die. It's a little more morbid than you thought.
Right. Everyone you love will die. I'm curious, what was the impetus behind writing this book and why did you do it?
So to scare the children of America. No, I wrote this book. So I have 2 children and next week I'll have 3 children. So I have, you know, soon to be 3 children and, you know, they're the loves of my life. And one of the great struggles for me is finding ways to talk about them, talk with them about sort of the tough realities that we all have to confront. And so I found that I do this well and that it gives me a window to talk to them if I write it out as a poem first. So it's almost like I get my thoughts straight with writing a children's poem, read this to them, and then we kind of bond over this and then we can have a meaningful discussion over it. So I've written poems about everything from you know, gay marriage to being an individual to Everyone You Love Will Die. And so Everyone You Love Will Die was the first one I wrote. And I wrote this poem when I was talking to my daughter, I believe after her fish died. And so I was talking to my oldest child about this and I put it on Facebook. I put it on Facebook and I said, hey, this is just kind of a funny thing I did. And it is ultimately hopeful and hopefully endearing. And encourages you to spend time and make the most of every moment with the people that you love. So I throw this thing on Facebook. The next day, a friend of mine sends me a file that she's illustrated this poem. So long story short, we put it on Kickstarter. Kickstarter made it their pick of the day. It was funded in like 5 hours. And, you know, we got enough money to print off a couple hundred books.
That's awesome. So Memento Mori for your toddler.
Yeah, Memento Mori for your toddler. Yeah, I love that. I love that concept.
Yeah, I think they need that. And it, I mean, it is true. Like, I think particularly in our modern world, I mean, even adults, like, we're so hidden. Like, we're so shielded from death, right? I mean, I can count on, like, maybe, you know, one hand. Not probably more than that. But, like, the number of people I've known that have died and experienced that. So, yeah, I mean, and kids even more so. We shield them from that stuff. But, like, that's a natural part of life.
Well, yeah. And for me, the reality of death is one of the things that most effectively animates me to try and live a meaningful life. And I think that we leave that value on the table when we hide from it. And the weird paradox is in a day and age where you turn on the TV on any given Tuesday and there's been a suicide bombing or a mass shooting, it's almost like death has become so ubiquitous that we're almost even that much more detached from it. So I think there's an appropriate and a meaningful way to reflect on the inevitability of loss as a way to animate a better life.
That's awesome. Well, Daniel, this has been a great conversation. Where can people learn more about your different books you've got out there?
Yeah, so go check out The Laws of Wealth on Amazon. You can go to everyoneyoulovewilldie.com if you're so moved. You can follow me on Twitter at Daniel Crosby, and my wealth management firm is Nocturne Capital.
Awesome. Daniel Crosby, thank you so much for time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
My guest today was Daniel Crosby. He's the author of the book, The Laws of Wealth. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Also, check out the show notes at aom.is/Crosby for links to resources mentioned throughout the show. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoyed the show and have gotten something out of it, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us out a lot. As always, thank you for your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.